Welcome back to Preacher Handshake. I'm Evan.
And I'm Hannah, and we're your hosts.
This week on Preacher Handshake, we talk with Reverend Dr. Aitzan Wright Riggins.
Reverend Dr. Aitzan Wright Riggins, or Reverend Ace, is the intentional interim pastor at First Baptist Church, Kennett Square in Southeast Pennsylvania. For almost 25 years, he was the chief executive officer of the American Baptist Home Mission Societies and Judson Press, where he was designated executive director emeritus at his retirement. Previously, he was pastor of the Macedonia Baptist Church in South Central Los Angeles and served as the director of peace and justice with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization founded by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He's also the mayor of Collegeville, Pennsylvania. He has a doctorate from the Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology at Virginia Union University, a Master of Divinity degree from the Berkeley School of Theology, a BA in the Sociology of Comparative Religions from California State University at Fullerton, and has been further awarded a Doctor of Humane Letters from Benedict College and Doctor of Divinity degrees from Alderson Broaddus College, Ursinus College, and the American Baptist Seminary of the West. He's married to the Reverend Betty Wright Riggins, an American Baptist minister who serves as spiritual director and chaplain at Ursinus College. They have three adult children and three grandchildren.
I wanted to talk to Aitzan. You hear that bio that Hannah just read, and it's overwhelming, the amount of degrees and accolades and things that he has done. I didn't even know about most of these things when I first met him. His humility and his desire to develop both the church and people and other ministers is just so evident. And so he has become a friend. And after first getting to meet him, to then continually learn about his accolades and the things that he has done. I knew that we needed to talk to him, and so I'm so grateful. And what I loved in this episode is the way that humility and passion for preaching, whether it's in huge contexts or to a handful of people, has never gone away. And that humility he brings with him everywhere he goes makes him a student of the craft of preaching and a great teacher for all of us to listen to.
Yeah, I love the humility that he speaks with. And, he talks about how long he's been preaching, how long he's been in ministry, and yet he still is learning things and was able to share and talk about how even now in his current, interim capacity, he's still learning. And I love that. I know this is an episode I'm going to go back and listen to with a notebook because there are so many things that I was like, oh, I need to write that down. This was really good. So I'm excited for people to hear it. Fantastic preacher. Crazy to be able to talk to somebody who's preached to two people and to massive congregations is really fun.
Yeah, so as always, you can listen to Aitzan's full sermon through the link in our show notes, and you will want a notebook with you at some point when you're listening to this one.
We hope you enjoy our conversation with Reverend Aitzan Wright Riggins.
Reverend Dr. Aitzan Wright Riggins, welcome. Thank you. We're so grateful and thankful that you are with us today.
Thank you. Really happy to be here. Appreciate it.
So we want to begin like we begin with all our guests and ask you about what's your relationship with preaching?
Actually, this year I celebrate my 65th year of preaching. I began as a boy preacher, and when I really say 65th year, I probably really should say 67th year. I began as a boy preacher at the age of 7 years old. Was licensed at the age of 10 on June 19th, 1960, which was Juneteenth, African American celebration of emancipation, but also the year I was licensed by my local church as a preacher. I really felt a really strong call to preach right after my baptism in a local African American church in South Central Los Angeles. Made the mistake on one Sunday evening telling my pastor that I'd have this dream and this urge to preach. And he said, "Well, when do you want to start preaching?" I said, "As soon as possible." And the next Wednesday evening, I preached my very first sermon from Exodus 20, called The Importance of One, looking at Moses being called to lead in the liberation of the Hebrews out of Egypt. And so I've been preaching except for now 65, 70, 65, 67 years. And also just celebrated my 50th year as an ordained minister. I was ordained 20, 50 years ago, 1975, right out of seminary.
Wow, I think you win for the earliest age of our preaching
All
guests so
my
far.
life, yeah, right.
And
Longer than anybody. And
what a first text.
still trying to figure this thing out. Yeah,
Are
really
we all
still trying to
right?
figure it out. It never gets any easier, and it never gets you never exhaust the depth of the challenge of preaching.
Well, I know the sermon we're looking at today is one that you preached as an interim. So I'm just curious, who are the people that you feel called to preach to generally? And then who is the congregation that you were preaching to specifically for this sermon?
Wow, who am I called to preach to generally? I mean, I have been a pastor. I pastored for 25 years in South Central Los Angeles. I've been a denominational executive for American Baptist Churches USA and preached all over, not only all over the country, but all over the world. Preach in my local church still, and now as an interim. For me, I think I have generally felt most comfortable and at home preaching in a pastoral setting. Though I'm oftentimes a special guest preacher, which and to me they're very different kind of it's a different kind of thing to be the guest preacher as opposed to being the pastoral preaching. I enjoy pastoral preaching. Currently, I'm serving as the intentional interim executive intentional interim pastor at First Baptist Church of Kennett Square, and preaching in that context. Is really preaching to a congregation that's in transition. And in many ways has been in transition for many years, though it has been only most recently without a senior pastor. And perhaps that's not even the way to say that because it really has not really had a pastor for perhaps maybe 3 or 4 years. But the person who has been there recently passed, who had stepped away as senior pastor and was elder of outreach. But trying to help and preaching in that context, in a transitional context, has been a new thing for me and a new thing for that congregation. And I think it has been a different kind of preaching task.
Well, we'll have some questions about how you approach that differently
Sure,
as we look at
absolutely.
the sermon. But before that, I'd love to hear a little bit about what your sermon prep process typically looks like.
Well, for me, depending on how I look at preaching, there are two ways in which I look at preaching. For me, preaching is first of all a kind of a holistic and experiential event in which I'm attempting to take what I have garnered through my study of Scripture and to present that to a congregation generally in a celebrative and joyous context in which communally we are celebrating and engaging in a task. And so generally I will either come from through the preaching task certainly out of a time of prayer. I try to approach any scripture reading that I do first of all to ask, what is this text saying to me? I might use a lectionary for to just kind of keep guide me in terms of to try to keep my preaching and my own intellectual stimulation fresh. What is this text saying to me? And then beginning to ask the question, therefore, and what is it then saying in this particular situation. So, I mean, there's the exegesis, that there's a prayerful preparation, and then there's always the whole question of, who are these people? What is this text saying to the ancient readers and hearers of this text? But then asking the question, what it is it's saying in this particular setting? And that's always one of the reasons I was just saying that I prefer pastoral preaching or preaching in to a congregation from which I'm familiar is generally I know who I'm speaking to. I know the people and I know what they're going through. Historically, for 25 years, being on the real road and preaching, oftentimes just walking into a congregation and having no idea who these people are and trying to get a feel for that in that context in that moment means that whatever was written on the page or whatever I thought about all during the week or the weeks leading up to it oftentimes changes just in terms of meeting those people and getting a sense of what's happening there. So my preparation is you know, a lot of preparation, prayer is. It's exegesis, it's getting to know the congregation. It is trying to figure out what is the central claim of this text. More often than not, I follow a process that was taught to me by Dr. Henry Mitchell, where I'm focused on what is this sermon attempting to move people to do and to be? Which is a different than, say, an intellectual or cognitive kind of thing in terms of how am I trying to change a mind. And part of the struggle with that is as an African American preacher and coming out of an African American context, I think out of the oral tradition and experiential tradition of African American churches, we are oftentimes more focused on how does this message move me, which is both a combination of both the emotion and the intellect. And oftentimes in your American context, it is thinking of more in terms of how is this message trying to change my mind. And so oftentimes when I'm in a Euro-American context, as I am currently, trying to wrestle with the differences between those cultural differences becomes somewhat of a challenge and leads to some more times a different way of presenting a text depending upon on the context in which I'm preaching it.
We have a new pastoral ministry resident in our congregation, and she comes out of the African American tradition. And her first Sunday was on Sunday, and she said to me, "Is it hard to preach when everybody's so quiet?"
Well, you know, it's very, 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 you know, it's very interesting, Evan, that you would say that. My very first non-African American preaching context really happened, 15 years after I began preaching. So I probably began to say 10 years old. And then when we was in my second year, middle year in seminary, when I went to the First Baptist Church of Ontario, California. And preach. In fact, the fellow that was there, Ralph Lightbody, had actually come out of the Drexel Hill Baptist Church in Philadelphia, and then I went out to Ontario. So I was the African American in this large Euro-American congregation, and that was a initially that was a strange experience for me because they were just absolutely quiet. And back then, I used to think they weren't listening, they weren't attentive, they weren't moved by it. But I have come to see over the years. That Euro-American congregations are just as responsive as African-American congregations. You just have to read them differently. I mean, it's a blink of an eye, it's a shift of a head, it's a tear down the cheek, it's an expression on a face. So I no longer feel intimidated by that or that there's a tremendous amount of difference. It's just a different language, a different way of communicating, and a different way of hearing. It does take some while, and I can empathize with your intern, with the person in residence there. That yes, it's very, very different when you have a congregation that is talking back to you, you hear them verbally than one that is just sitting there and kind of looking at you, and
Makes sense.
you don't know how to read them yet.
You got to learn to pay attention to the head nods and the
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. Or the falling asleep.
right? There is some of
For
that for
sure.
sure.
Right.
Well, today we're looking at a sermon you preached at the First Baptist Church of Kennett Square on July 27th, 2025, titled Let's Hear It for the G Words, and it's based off Acts 2, 40 through 47.
Yeah, and you begin to ask what makes a church, and then you jump into this story about Ichabod and the lament of glory departed. And so I want to listen to that clip.
I once heard Dr. James Cone, James Forbes, who was the pastor of Riverside Church in Riverside. He preached about a day when the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant, as recorded in 1 Samuel, the 4th chapter. Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. Philistines' Ark of the covenant. And on that same day, a Jewish mother gave birth to a child. But upon hearing the news of the devastating loss of the Ark of the Covenant and the loss of her husband and of her father-in-law, she named her child Ichabod. Ichabod is a Hebrew word which simply means no glory. Or where is the glory? To declare Ichabod is to lament a glory that has been departed. A glory that has been departed. There are about 5,800 American Baptist churches in the United States of America, but not one of those churches names itself the Ichabod Baptist Church. No one wants to say that God's glory has departed. I think most of us want a church that makes us say, gee, gee. Webster defines G as an interjection. And an interjection is simply a word or a phrase that expresses a sudden feeling, an emotion, or a reaction. It is a word that is grammatically independent from the rest of any sentence that might follow. It says it all by itself, G. It doesn't have to modify other words or form a structural part of a sentence. When expressed positively, it is an expression of enthusiasm, of joy, and sometimes surprise.
I love how you dove into that concept and got to this these G words. But I'm thinking about as an interim and coming into this context where they have gone through so much transition and gone through loss to lose a beloved leader. You know, did you feel that tension as you're setting that up of perhaps a fear within the congregation? Like there isn't any congregation going through transition, you know, has the glory departed, right? Do we have a future? You know, even if we don't want to name ourselves the First Baptist Church of Ichabod or whatever, how did you navigate that tension? And were you trying to tap into something that maybe is unsaid, but within that community as you're in the interim pastor?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think I was trying to do work operate on two levels there. I think that certainly I was attempting to speak to where this congregation might be, but I was also trying to paint, I think, a picture of where I think many congregations are, where many of us are. I think that many of us are caught between what is or what was. What was and what is, or what was and what could be. I think that in preaching, it's really important to create an emotional space that perhaps people can identify with, so that ultimate that first of all, I'm not aiming towards the head, but trying to aim towards the heart, or where people are. So I think what I was trying to set up there was many of us, whether we're thinking institutionally, corporately, or just personally where we are, am I in an Ichabod space? Are we in an Ichabod space? I was also without saying a whole lot about it, trying to identify with my experience with this church, in that I first came into a contact with First Baptist Church of Kennett Square when I moved to Pennsylvania in 1991, 1992. A colleague of mine was making a presentation there, say about 1992, on missions and ABC missions, and I was there with her as she made that presentation to the church. And I remember that Sunday morning, being there, and the entire congregation was filled. I remember that Sunday morning in which they so it had to be 250, 200 people, 200 people in the congregation that on that Sunday morning. I remember the excitement as they were talking about missions and all the visuals and the choir and all of this kind of thing. Now we were worshiping community on a Sunday morning, 35, 40 people. They have not had a senior pastor for several years, a settled pastor, I should say, for several years. And their beloved pastoral leader for the last 10 years had struggled with cancer. And then passed just over a year ago as a member of the church, as one of the now former pastors still part of the church. So I think that I was trying to create this experience of having them initially identify with, are we the church where people walk in and say, gee, wow, what's excitement? Or are we in this spot where, has the glory departed? And where are we with that? And if that's where we are, what can we do? Who can we be to recapture the sense of awe, the sense of God's presence and a dynamism that may not be yesterday, but certainly can be God's a presentation of that as to who we are and can be today and tomorrow.
Yeah, I love the attentiveness to maybe what people are feeling and what maybe they need. You immediately go into kind of your first G word that maybe all of them come out of, this God-centeredness.
As we lose that vital connection to the source of our life and our purpose, potentially we become what John talked about in Revelation 3, lukewarm. When we're not God-centered, when we're not of God aware, when we're not God-praising, conflicts begin to arise over trivial matters. When we're not looking above and thinking about praising God, we'll be concerned about what color are the carpets and who makes the decision about what are the elements that we'll use on Sunday morning. We become focused on ourselves and not on God.
I love this comment about thinking of things that are not God-centered and that we become focused on that when we've lost kind of the focus. But I can also hear some of the opposite argument, which is no, the color of our carpets does matter, or the things, even as you bring up the elements that we're using do matter. And so I think there's a lot of opinions that people have in the church who would say, like, these don't seem very trivial to me. So
Sure.
I guess I'm wondering, how do you determine when the church becomes concerned with things that truly are trivial or when they're things that are God-centered?
I think that a lot of it for me centers around why we go or why we worship, or why we connect in the first place. As I listen to myself, and very seldom do I review, watch or listen to what I've said before. But as I listen, the first thing that I thought about, I thought about my grandmother, and sometimes when she would go to church and out at when she'd come back home from church, and I'd ask my grandmother. I said, Grandma Laura, how was church today? What did the preacher say? And she'd look at me and she said, "I don't remember what he said, but it sure was good." what that taught me back then was her connection with church, her connection with worship was an experience. It was first of all an experience that in that context she met God. What I found in my experience as a denominational executive and as a person that is in and out of all various kinds of churches is that oftentimes we will struggle and fight about theology as to whether or not we have a conservative or progressive or liberal or fundamentalist, whatever theology. What I have found with folks that more important for me around those experiences was not necessarily the particular theological strain as much as it was about whether or not folks had a sense of being in the presence of God, however one theologically looked at it, or whether or not one was focusing not so much in terms of the transcendent power of God or and the immanent power of God, but thinking more in terms of church as being simply a social gathering, simply a routine that one did on Sunday morning. That for me, the empowerment of a church, the growth of a church, the spiritual life of a church, really has had more to do with one's connection with a sense of what one person called the mysterium tremendum, the power and the efficacy of God. So, but to me, when people fail both to do that and to do so in a communal manner. Okay, not just me and God, but us and God. That's where I'm trying to go. Where when people fail as a community to be persons in the presence of an all-powerful, loving God, we begin to think about other. I think about one of my seminary professors who said, there's a primary theological affirmation, and then there's secondary theological formulations. The primary theological affirmation is that Jesus Christ is Lord. Then there's secondary formulations after that. I think that oftentimes we focus on the secondary formulations, and sometimes the secondary formulations are the color of the carpet. Sometimes the secondary formulations are the church polity. The secondary formulations are whether or not we're going to sing hymns or anthems or praise songs. But when we move away from our corporate identity and connection with an all-loving, all-powerful, concerned, loving God, I think that we get lost in the weeds. And so, yeah, some of these things are important, currently important. But I don't think that they are the primary piece of what we're called to do in our worship. But when we are able to see ourselves in relationship with this loving God and aware of God's awesomeness, I think it makes a tremendous difference. And then when we're not aware of that, I think we fall victim to other problematic pieces in our churches.
Yeah, I love the way that you defined that. And in some ways, these secondary things, maybe the question that's most important about them is wondering, where is God in this? And if what we find is that actually God maybe is not in so much the decisions of the carpet, then maybe we shouldn't be so concerned about it either.
Yesterday, or not yesterday, a couple of days ago, I was in Los Angeles, back at a church that I was a part of 40 years ago. My wife and I attended there on this past Sunday. And when we walked in, we were just in initially, we were aware of the physical deterioration of the church. That was our first thing. Oh, this church is so physically different than it was 40 years ago. When we walked in there were six or seven people in the church. They hadn't really assembled yet. We came in, said, "Oh my, they're just falling apart. This is that, the other." But 15 minutes later, 15 minutes later, the physical condition of the property all but vanished because the vitality that was in that congregation and in that place was greater than what I remembered that congregation being 30, 40 years ago. So, we could have been focused on the carpet and the pews. We could have been focused on the tarnished paint. We could have been focused on the socioeconomic differences in that community and been in this woe is me place. But those folks had a real vital connection with the Spirit of God in such a way that none of that made any difference. And we found ourselves just 10, 15 minutes into that space saying, "Oh my gosh, how wonderful it is to be here." All everything else, the condition of the property and everything else, all of that was nothing to us.
What a valuable insight. I think about in my own context, we call this podcast Preacher Handshake because so often the only feedback we get after our sermons is in that kind of handshake line at the end. But I think the best Sundays for me in my context, I get back to the back of the church and the service ends and nobody comes back to me because they're all just together. They're all talking and getting together. And that's to me a reflection of the presence of God that has very little to do with whatever I said. Like you
Yeah.
said earlier, right? I don't know what he said, but it was good.
Right.
There's power there, and there's power in that community that's committed to following Jesus together. And so one of your G words is gather. And as you're talking about that, you mentioned the survey that the congregation is doing as they're searching, developing a portfolio to search for a pastor, which what a great tool for exegeting your congregation. Would we all have surveys where they could express some of their thoughts? I want to share a clip from that too.
I noticed that one of the things in our survey as we're beginning to look for a pastor, one of the things that was high on the list was we want an evangelistic pastor. We wanted somebody that would open the doors of the church. And God knows we know that. But you know what? We need even more than that. We need some people who will close the back doors of the church. Because more often than not, the contemporary church does not have a problem opening its front doors, it has a problem of flocking the sheep in such a way that they want to gather, that they want to be together, and they run out the back door. So, just as a word of counsel to you this morning, I would ask you to think about for a moment, who were those persons that you have not seen in the last 4 to 6 weeks? Because church analysts will tell you that if a person has not been seen for 4 to 6 weeks, generally something is happening in their life. Or something is happening in their relationship with the people that they were together with. Something is going on that leads them to isolation, that leads them to not being connected. So, yes, while we want to open the doors of the church and introduce people to Jesus Christ, we also want to make sure that they understand that we love them, that we care for them, that we're there for them, that we will refuse to have them isolated, because gathering is important.
I appreciate how you take this moment to become more of a interim kind of consultant guide that maybe isn't the normal role of a pastor in a more permanent position. And so to go back to some of the things you mentioned earlier, I want to hear how your preaching has changed as you've taken on this interim role in this context.
While I've said that preaching in a Euro-American context and African-American context, I'm comfortable in those settings. I'm also aware, just in preaching in general in the Euro-American context, that there are certain pieces that seem to be more important in Euro-American congregations than they are in African-American congregation. Some of my preaching, it is just watching myself here. I'm back and forth with a manuscript in this context. Generally, in an African American context, I don't use a manuscript at all, and much more of my preaching is much more narrative, and conversational, and in connecting. But specifically in this interim context. I think it's different because I think that part of the only opportunity that I really have to consult the congregation is on a Sunday morning. It is the church context in which I'm engaged is not a church context where there's a whole lot of meetings during the week. This is very, very different. I don't know if this is a post-COVID thing. Or if this is a generational thing or a shift in the church, but most of what happens with the congregation and membership of the church happens on a Sunday morning. So I've had to try to get used to doing both some of the business and some of the consulting on a Sunday morning. So in some of my preaching, and even in this particular sermon, some of the preaching. Is really the consulting that I would normally do with a leadership team on a Wednesday night or a Saturday afternoon. So my preaching has become both a proclamation and a narrative and a consulting with the congregation and really combining a number of things. So that would not necessarily be part of my general preaching style, but because there is so much to happen and so much to happen in 1 hour. I've been a part of churches that the preacher doesn't even get up until after the church's service has been gone for an hour or so. But having to do what I need to do in that 15, 20 minutes and be out of there within an hour means that a whole lot of different kind of things have to happen in processing it in a different kind of way. So I'm learning even as I'm going. Dealing with folks and dealing with trying to fulfill what I consider preaching, and at the same time trying to be helpful as a consultant at the same time, and combining that is a different kind of thing.
I imagine that the interim piece of that is a different type of pastoral care that you're doing, different than if you were with a congregation for a long period of time. But I love the way that you're really attentive to that.
Yeah, and to try to do it, I've already been there longer than I had intended to be, I've seen that the grieving cycles have been longer than I thought it would be, and also something that I'd learned long before in another context. I'm also learning here. My mentor also always used to say, when you would go to a church, he'd always say, "Don't use your influence until you get it." Meaning that that you really don't become, it takes a while to become the pastor. And one of the things that I had not really given as much thought to going into this particular situation was that it actually takes longer to truly become the interim than I thought it would take. So it really took a good 6 months just to become the interim. And to a place where people begin to trust you and listen to you in such a way that then you might be able to move them forward. So we are really just entering another space where we're able to take a more significant steps. But taking that time to get to know the people and people to get to know me in such a way that we can move a process along has been a learning experience for both me and for them, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you're not just talking about your congregation, but you also address maybe the needs of the community and the people that are around you in this particular space. So I'd like to listen to you talk about that.
The scripture says they distribute to any who had need. What this implies is that generosity is the spirit and the willingness to both assess and meet needs without reservation. Yeah, they assessed people's needs. Yeah, they did an interview. They said, what's going on? What do you need? They did some means testing, but their testing wasn't mean. Yeah. They asked the question, what do you need? They did means testing, but the testing wasn't mean. I'm sick and tired of churches and nonprofit organizations and governments that do mean testing rather than means testing. Sometimes we punish those who find themselves with their backs against the wall. Sometimes we say it's your own darn fault for getting in the situation that you've gotten. Sometimes you make people feel absolutely guilty and horrible about extending a cup of cold water to them.
Man, that section is a master class on using language really well. This difference between means testing and mean testing. So I'm curious what advice you would give for how to assess needs in your community and your congregation without passing judgment. How do you know when you're participating in mean testing instead of means testing?
I think in the immediate, I just go back to that golden rule that we were taught as children, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. If, you know, how would you feel if you were treated this way, if people related to you this way? I mean, mean testing is where we come judgmentally or with our presuppositions or as though we actually know what people are going through, and posturing ourselves as being judge, jury, and executioner, posturing ourselves as knowing what is best for people, and looking down at others. So, I mean, whenever I think whenever we look down our noses, whenever we assume a superiority, whether that is based upon our theological acumen, whether it is based upon our race or our gender, our sexuality, and making those kind of judgments, and make people whenever we make people feel small or little. That's mean testing.
Yeah, we never really graduate from the greatest commandments, do we, of loving God and
No.
loving others?
You know, we oftentimes talk about the Great Commission, even the evangelist, and then the Great Commandment, but oftentimes say that we also need to look at what I call the Great Criteria. We talk about Matthew 28, the Great Commission. We talked about the Great Commandment, loving God and loving neighbor. But I also say there's the Great Criteria, and the Great Criteria for me is Matthew 25. I think it's Matthew 25, 31, where Jesus said, "As often as you do this to the least of these, you've done it to me." Is that that oftentimes we need to be aware that we see that every person that we meet is in somehow a reflection of Christ, and we need to respond to that person with that criteria.
You also talk about the community's impression of the church and maybe how people are responding to the congregation.
The scripture says they praise God and had favor with all the people. The grace from the perspective, this implicit grace, that it was about them. They had grace. They were people that when they looked at, when people from the outside looked at them, they would say, these are people that are full of grace. These are people, in other words, it says they found favor with the people. People looked kindly upon them. They said they are graceful people. The best way I know how to put this is that It said there was an aroma about them. There was a spirit about them. There was something. Have you ever been up against people that just made you feel good just to be in their presence? There was just, when people feel good in their own skin, when people are just themselves, when people are around you in a way that is just wonderful, there was a spirit and aroma. They were filled with grace.
I love this comment about how the community is viewing the congregation. You know, I'm in a context where I'm in a new church and I'm trying to think about what are practices, what are habits, what are things that we can do to cultivate an impression in the community that is viewed graciously, is viewed favorably. Because unfortunately, that's not the case with every church. So what do you think are some practices that churches can embrace to be viewed graciously by their community?
Before I come up with sharing some things around that, I think about one of the practices that I had and still have as a guest speaker. Oftentimes when I'd be invited to preach in a church, if I was preaching at a 10 o'clock worship service, I'd actually arrive in the neighborhood of the church an hour or so earlier. And I'd get out of my car and I would walk a couple of blocks around the church and hopefully meeting some people in the neighborhood or in the main streets around the church. And I would just ask them, oh, excuse me, do you know where First Baptist Church is? And just a one or two blocks away to see, number one, do they know that there's a church in the area? And what can you tell me about that church? Because it would give me a handle on what was the posture of that church in the community of the people that live there. I think about the church where I pastored for in South Central Los Angeles. One of the things I did as a new pastor there was I took the leaders on a walking tour of the neighborhood. And it was really kind of interesting because some of the members of that church had been members of that church 10 or 20 years and had never been in the neighborhood of the church out. They would come to the building, but it never circled around the neighborhood and just having conversations with people in the church. But I think that some of the things that a congregation needs to do to express goodwill are simply do listening sessions, listening to the neighborhood to find out what the needs are, and ministering and providing opportunity, ministering to those needs. One of the things I really appreciate about First Baptist Church of Kennett Square is we have 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that happen during the week, Monday through Saturday. Our parking lot is filled midday with people that are coming to what we call midday miracles. We actually have more people that are coming to our Alcoholics Anonymous meetings during the middle of the day than we have congregants on Sunday morning. And while the church itself may say, well, you know, this is not necessarily what we are doing. What we ourselves are doing, because they sometimes make this distinction between what happens in the church and what happens on a Sunday morning. It has developed a reputation in the community as a church that really does care and a church that is non-judgmental about where people are. So I think that some of the things that the church does is opening its doors to the least, the locked out, the left behind. I think that anytime we can give a message that we care. So as an example, one of the things that is happening with our congregation, we have a Guatemalan congregation that meets in our facilities. We post some of our signs in Spanish. We provide opportunities for them to know what is happening around ICE. And immigration issues, so that both that congregation and those in the neighborhood know that we are a congregation that is concerned about issues of justice and concerned about the fear that people are living with. So I just think that there is just a kind of a posture that one is willing to be helpful, to be loving, to be embracing of the people that are in that neighborhood, that that we are here for the entire community. We're not just here for those who are worshiping here on Sunday morning.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, and what a gift that is to the community. It reminded me, there's this quote I pulled up from Richard Rohr, who talks about when the church forgets their own gospel message, the Holy Spirit sneaks in through the ducts and the air vents, and AA meetings have been very good ductwork, allowing fresh air both in and out of many musty and mildewed churches. These acts
Absolutely.
of grace creating space to remind us of our call. What a gift. Well, I want to show one more clip from this message about goodwill, one of your G words. Let's take a look at that.
But it also says, when it says they found favor and grace, it also meant they extended grace. That's a G word. They extended grace to other words, to them. In other words, when people were in their presence, they didn't feel like the people that were in their presence didn't feel like they were a burden to the church. They didn't feel like that they were somehow being ostracized by the church. They felt that there was no burden. They felt that they were welcomed into that place. They were infused with the aroma of Christ. Verse 37 also says they had favor with all the people. That's goodwill. Think about that for a moment. It didn't say they had favor with some people. It didn't say it had favor with selected people. It said they had favor with all the people. Their actions fostered a positive relationship, and it invoked a reputation throughout the wider community. They were seen as a blessing, not a burden, not a threat. I really like the way one denomination describes their church. One denomination, I believe it's the UCC, that says open doors and open hearts, not a burden, not a threat. How do people feel about First Baptist Church when they drive by, when they walk by, when they come by? Are we a threat to them? Are we a burden to them? Do they feel that we are ready to judge them? Or do they feel that we are ready to welcome them? When the glory departs, when God is not in that place, this building becomes a fortress to fight rather than a hospital to welcome.
Love that return to the glory. Well, we've talked some about adjustments you've made to pastor at Kennett Square. I'm curious how you've seen goodwill growing and how you've seen adjustments being made from a Euro-American church context, adjusting to having you step into the role as their interim pastor. What have you seen, and how has there been growth and change among them?
I'll oftentimes say I've been black all my life. And because of who I've been all of my life and the context in which I do what I do, and it may be naive of me, but I oftentimes don't think about what my presence. I don't self-consciously think about what my presence might mean in terms of of the difference that that makes in that context. And I guess part of what I guess I'm saying is, I think that over the years, over time, I've developed a sense of bicultural fluency, being able to relate both across white and black and other cultural lines, that I don't think a whole lot about that. Having said that, I would say that I do think that my presence, perhaps both as an African American and my presence as one who may think somewhat different theologically than some of the members of my congregation, I will find myself saying, "Oh, the fact that I am black and the fact that theologically and politically I'm different has made a difference." So, as an example, I remember when I first came to interview with the congregation or have a conversation, one of the members of the church said something to me about my position on social issues, which blew me away. He said, "Oh yeah, we know your position on social issues. We've researched you. We've looked you up on YouTube and all that." I said, "Oh, okay." And he wasn't particularly happy about some of my particular perspectives around that. But having been there for a year, I have seen that because what I try to do is I try my best to be a Christian. I try my best to love everybody. I try my best to not allow the cultural, racial, political, theological differences between us to become the main thing, but rather the main thing is that God is our Father and Christ is our brother, and we are siblings. I've noticed a difference in the way we connect, that he can laugh about some of the political and theological differences. So I think that yes, in that sense, my presence has made a difference. Being black, being a politician, I'm also the mayor of my little town. So one of the ways I oftentimes talk about preaching. Preaching to me is the communication of truth through personality. Well, I think that the difference we make in our lives and people's lives is simply communicating our truth through our personality. If we show up authentically as ourselves, whatever that is, and do so with a gospel perspective, I think we can make a tremendous difference in our relationships and in our world and our churches and in our communities. And I think I've seen that at First Baptist, that growth and development in me and in them as a result of navigating some of these superficial differences and sometimes not so superficial.
Thank you for sharing that.
So, what are you most proud of in this sermon?
One of the things when you asked me to do this, I intentionally just chose a sermon that I just did. And I was not trying to choose a sermon that, I brought the house down. I was not trying to choose a sermon that was one of what I would call a stellar message. I mean, I have the distinction of I preached in some of the smallest storefront churches in the world. I preached to two people in a little storehouse, a storefront church. I've also preached at Riverside Church in New York City, a national I preached at a national cathedral. So I think what I'm most proud of, if that's even a way to say it, is I think I'm proud of, I just believe in this stuff. I'm proud of the fact that I stick with it and keep trying to do it. I may never, I think my days as a full-time settled pastor pastor over. I served for 25 years as executive director, CEO of the Home Mission Board for American Baptist Churches USA. I've done a whole lot of stuff. I've traveled all over. But one of the things I think I'm most proud of is that the essential calling on my life that came at 7 years old and licensed at 10 years old is that I've never stopped preaching, and I've never stopped believing the efficacy of preaching, and I will continue to do it. And so I'm proud of trying to communicate the gospel across theological, cultural, political differences, because I just believe that it works, ultimately works.
So one of the things that we ask everyone is, why do you think preaching matters today?
I think that if preaching is a holistic experiential event, that gives people an experience, an alternative experience of what is, I think we have to do that with all of our might. I think it was Viktor Frankl, this is a Jewish example. He said in one of his books or sayings, he said something to the effect of, a person can deal with just about any how if he or she has a why. And for me, preaching at its best gives people an experience of why, that allows them to deal with the how. I think that where we are as and in our society right now, where people feel hemmed in on every side, just trying to make a living, trying to make a life, trying to move forward. If preaching can provide a narrative and an experience where people experience the transcendence of God, the immanence of God, the hope of God, the love of God in such a way, that gives them that why that then makes the how possible. And that at pre and for me at its best, what I'm trying to do week by week is to help people to make it through the next week, to make it through the next crisis, to make it through the next administration, to make it through the next night, midnight. And for me, that is what the preacher's task is. And that task, ideally, is not his or her task alone, but that preaching event becomes a communal event in which the congregation itself is so wrapped up in the story and the narrative and the experience that they know, I've gone through this today. I've tasted freedom. I've tasted love. I've tasted liberation. I've tasted a new reality, and therefore I can go on. So that's why I continue to preach, and why I think preaching is so very, very important. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice in our churches when we decide preaching is passé, let's just do a TED hour on a Sunday morning, or let's just do something, let's entertain. I think it's the communication of that truth, the reality of God's presence, that becomes transformative, and why I do it and why I think we ought to continue to do it.
Well, Reverend Haitsan Wright Riggins, what a blessing it has been to learn from you and look at this sermon together. Thank you so much for your time
Thank
and
you.
your willingness to speak with us. It's been a real blessing.
Thank you so very much, Yubo.
Thanks for listening to our conversation with Reverend Haitsan Wright Riggins. If you want to keep up with Haitsan and his work or listen to his full sermon, check out the links in our show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and follow us on whatever platform you get your podcasts and share with your friends. You can keep up with all things Preacher Handshake on our Instagram at Preacher Handshake, or email us your questions or preacher recommendations at preacherhandshake@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.